I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Don't Call Me Shirley edition. It's Wednesday, April 29th, 2020. On today's show, Unorthodox tells the story of a young woman escaping her Hasidic community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and thereby also her arranged marriage. It's a four-parter on Netflix. And then we're joined by Jesse David Fox of New York Magazine and Vulture and the Good One podcast to talk about the state of comedy in an age of pandemic. And finally, this was Julia's week to comfort us with a movie, and so she picked the 1980 comedy classic Airplane! Exclamation point. Julia, I cannot wait to talk to you about this movie. You are the deputy managing editor of the LA Times, and hey, how you doing?
Hello. I am delighted to talk about Airplane! With you guys.
Superb. And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate. Hey, Dana.
Hey there, Stephen. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Okay. Before we actually fully dive in this week, Julia, we do have an announcement. What's up?
Yeah, we have an announcement. Slate, like many other journalistic institutions, is facing financial challenges right now as the ad market is really collapsing with so many businesses facing challenges from the coronavirus pandemic and the shutdowns to fight it. And they are changing some podcast schedules, including ours. We are going to be going bi-weekly. We'll be coming to you every other week and hope to be returning to a weekly schedule as soon as is possible. We thought about this a lot, and we've decided to take this moment to try to bring you an extra specially excellent version of the show, maybe taking advantage of the longer window to dig a little bit more deeply into some of our topics or tackle things that we wouldn't necessarily have had time to tackle on a weekly basis. So we hope to be bringing you a show that's just as sparkling as we aspire to every week. And of course, in each of those biweekly episodes, we'll have a Slate Plus segment. And we are, of course, all ears as to what you would like to hear us discuss. The single best thing you can do to help restore us to weekliness and to generally support Slate and all of the work and all of the great podcasts that it produces is to subscribe. So if you've been on the fence or thinking about it and you can afford it right now, it is a great, great time to subscribe to Slate Plus. It's just $35 for the first year. Go to slate.com/culture plus. You will help sustain this show, Slate's many great shows, and all of the wonderful journalism that Slate puts into the world. And if you've been on the fence, we'd be extremely grateful. Again, slate.com/culture plus. In the meantime, we love hearing from you. So please do email us at culturefest@slate.com. If there's a type of segment you've always wanted us to do that you think might be more doable on this schedule, we are all ears. And, you know, it's been, I think, really important for all of us to connect with each other during this very, very weird moment in history and life. And it's been really meaningful to us to hear from you all during this time. And so we are here. We will still be coming to you regularly. And we hope to be back weekly as soon as we can.
Julie, if I could just add a quick note to that, I just wanted to say that this was a hard decision for us to go bi-weekly. We were trying to figure out how we can continue to make the show on a reduced budget for the magazine. And we thought about putting part of it behind the paywall or doing other kinds of solutions. And ultimately, we just decided that we would rather continue to do the show that we've been doing with all the moving parts that you're used to and just do it less often and try to make each one as special as we can. So we really want to go back to being weekly again, and we're really grateful for your listenership.
Esty is short for Esther. She's a very young woman, 19 years old. She finds herself locked in an impossible life. She's a member of the Satmar movement, an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic sect in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Her mother has fled to Berlin to start a new existence, and who can blame her? Her father is a community drunk. I mean, who can blame him, too? Her life is defined by what she is not allowed to do. She's not allowed to keep her own hair. She's not allowed to swim in water. She's not allowed to play music. This last is especially painful. That's her passion. Most of all, she's not allowed to not marry Yankee, a nice enough, but I think we come to realize somewhat limited young man to whom she doesn't want to be married. So after a nightmare stint as a newlywed, Esty decides to escape to Berlin. Unorthodox is loosely based on a 2012 memoir by Deborah Feldman. It's a German-American production from many of the same people behind Deutschland 83, a very, very widely, highly praised show. Let me set up the clip a little bit. Esty finds herself in Berlin, and she falls in with a crowd of young, multicultural, very, very open-spirited music students, and they decide to all drive to the beach together.
Where are you from, Esty? New York.
Ooh.
You don't sound like you're from New York.
Never been anywhere else. Where are you from?
Yemen, but I grew up near Munich.
And I'm from Israel. Ahmed's from Nigeria. Clemens, German, but your parents came from
Poland.
Poland, right? And Robert's the only one of us who's actually from Berlin, so
he can answer all your burning questions about the war.
My grandparents lost their whole families in the camps.
So did half of Israel. But we're too busy defending our present to be sentimental about our past.
Dana, let me start with you. This has gotten a lot of attention. It asks a lot of, I think, very pointed and relevant questions beyond simply what it is to be a member of a Hasidic sect, like what it is to be Western and secular in the contemporary world. What do you make of it?
I mean, I highly recommend it. It's not quite like anything I've seen recently on Netflix or at the movies or anywhere else. For one thing, it's this 4-hour-long format, so it's not as long as a regular TV show, but it goes into way more detail about, for example, daily life in the Hasidic community than a movie would be able to. And within those 4 hours, I feel like there's two different threads, right? There's the Berlin story, which then becomes a kind of mystery chase plot with her husband and this other sort of prodigal son of the Jewish community being sent to look for her in Berlin. So there's a kind of fish out of water comedy with them looking for her, but also some real suspense about whether they will find her and what will happen if they do. And that's combined with, you know, an almost more anthropological approach of looking at what it's like inside this ultra-Orthodox community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I thought that one of those two worked better than the other. I don't know if you guys will agree with me, but I was much more interested in the Williamsburg flashbacks than in what was happening in Berlin. Shira Haas, the young woman who plays Esti, is so great that I loved every minute of the show just watching her, and she was fantastic. But it's the Berlin part of the show that is fictional. This is based on a memoir by Deborah Feldman, who went through a very similar experience up to the point of fleeing to Berlin. That's where the fiction of the show starts. And to me, there was a bit of an imbalance between those two parts, and I was always a little bit more interested when we were back in Brooklyn. And that may just be because, you know, it's closer to our own lives and experience. And, you know, if you've lived in New York, you're aware of those enclaves in Williamsburg that are Orthodox Jewish and Hasidic, and you don't know anything about what goes on within them. So that part was so fascinating that I was always a little bit disappointed when we got into fictional Berlin and the music students. But that said, I highly recommend all 4 hours of this. I thought it was great.
Oh, I don't know, Dana. I mean, the Berlin stuff feels funny because it's magic. It feels like almost unreal. Like she immediately befriends without much trouble a impossibly beautiful group of jovial conservatory students, like the place she goes for coffee. I mean, I guess maybe she did this on purpose, but she just happens to be near this youth conservatory and fall in with the group of people interested in exactly what she's interested in. I think actually the woman whose memoir this is based on did end up in Berlin eventually. So she did that part was also based on her experience, but that wasn't in the memoir that she wrote because it took longer for her to get there. But I agree that there's sort of this sense of like, wow, it's really all going to work out for this young escapee. But I kind of liked that because I think the sort of spy thriller slash heightened version of the life she has been missing, where whether, you know, man or woman or gay or straight or from no matter where you're from, you could possibly grow up in a world where you were expected to devote your life to the pursuit of art, and the way in which she learns a bit about how the rigors of that life have their own constraints as well. I don't know. I enjoyed that counterbalance. Like, I think that's part of what makes this show so snackable. And I think, you know, just in general, the sense that it's like a chase story, like someone's on the run and someone's pursuing them, which you usually see in like a espionage context, mm-hmm. makes the anthropology of this feel, you know, gives you more patience for the attention of the anthropology part of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, weirdly, I agree with both of you, if it's possible to square that circle. The ethnographically specific and quite granularly detailed aspect of that one half of the story, I think, is just beautifully done. It looks amazing. You feel as though, Dana, you're right, you've penetrated into the heart of this kind of open mystery that surrounds people who are not part of that community but live right next to it in Brooklyn. It struck me as very authentic. Shira Haas is amazing as this character, amazing to look at, amazing to listen to. You want to follow this person on her journey. And then, Julie, I agree with you. I think just in terms of dramatic necessity, you need the person to escape. And it would work well to have elements of suspense about, you know, how gangster-like are these two young men going to go? Moisha, especially, the one who accompanies Yankee. Yankee, we're meant to believe, is basically a sympathetic human being. I mean, that's the tragedy of it, is that he's not, he too is being ground down and destroyed in some basic human way by sort of ideological rigidity of this sect. And Dana, I'll just come back to the question that I sort of semi-started with, which is the viewer of the target viewer of this is going to be a basically middle class, basically Western, basically secular person for the most part. Did you feel as though that in any way the show was prejudiced or tilted towards the prejudices of such a person, or that the prejudices of such a person went somewhat slightly under-examined by the show?
Yeah, I mean, speaking as such a person with maybe those blinders on, I'm not sure that I'm able to answer that completely. I know that there was a piece in the foreword by a woman from the same sect, the Satmar sect, who had also left the community, who objected to the movie and thought that it stereotyped members of the Hasidic community and made their life look, I believe she was saying, more repressive than it actually is. It was not totally clear to me what her objections were as a former member of that community, especially given that she also had chosen to leave it. But to me, as an outsider, I thought it towed that line incredibly well. I mean, it would be so easy for this movie to have villainized, for example, the husband, mm-hmm. Yankee, the character who comes after her in Berlin, who's played by Amit Rahav, this Israeli actor who I thought was just fantastic in the role. And I think the movie treats him with such delicacy. You see how trapped he is by the culture as well. He is certainly a repressive husband in the sense that, you know, he believes in all kinds of patriarchal laws of that culture. And I think the show does want us to see her as fleeing that for her own betterment and her own freedom. But it doesn't see him as an abusive or cruel figure. There's a whole part of the storyline when we're in the flashbacks of their marriage and what went wrong about how they have difficulty having sex. And there's not an implication in any of those scenes that he is forcing himself on her. In fact, on the contrary, he's trying his best to understand what sexuality is, because both of them were brought up in such a repressed way that they essentially made it to the point of marriage without understanding how human reproduction works. And to see them struggling with that is really painful for both characters. But you might have to talk to someone who's a little bit closer to that community, or who is just religious at all, to see whether that's a fair interpretation or just mine as a secular person.
I agree that the portrayal of Yankee is really great, because you see that he's also scared and nervous and confused and ill-prepared for some of the things they face. But I did like the line. I was glad to read that perspective from the woman writing in the foreword. And one point she makes is that a lot of people in the community are portrayed as cold, humorless, and obsessed with following the rules. And she points out, "I have always known Williamsburg to be a lively world of gossip, drama, peer pressure, materialism, competition, family, and busybody neighbors. The people in Unorthodox are not that." And that did give me a flash of, you know, we basically have sort of one sympathetic woman in her grandmother, who is, you know, a Holocaust survivor, who is very bought into the Satmar rules. And I think part of why Esty is so excited to get married and so bought into the idea of this arranged marriage at the beginning, and seems to feel, you know, scared but happy.
I think the wedding sequence was really, really extraordinary, and was apparently put together, you know, with tons of help from consultants from within that Satmar community, and essentially trying to film the ritual of a wedding in that culture exactly as it occurs. And not only is the wedding sequence, I think, one of the high points of the show, I believe it happens in episode 2, but if you want to learn something about how the whole show was put together and specifically the wedding sequence, there's a really great short on Netflix, which you can find after you watch the show. I recommend you watch it after because it might have some spoilers in it. It's 20 minutes long, and it's just one of those behind-the-scene featurettes that interviews the makers, including the Hasidic consultant who helped to make the wedding as accurate as it apparently is, and, you know, talking about the costumes and how they were created, how hot it was dancing in those fur hats on a summer day as they were filming. So I highly recommend, after you watch this, if you want to dig a little deeper, watching that Netflix making of short.
I would say my own, well, this is very well done and people should watch it, but my quibble with it is that an ethnography is equally possible, a critical ethnography is equally possible, you know, when it comes to supposedly open, supposedly liberal Westerners, the culture from which I come. Like, it is possible to hold that at least half an arm's length and ask, what are its codes, what are its pecking orders, what are its codes of inclusion and exclusion? And instead, it's really represented almost completely as just boundaryless, fluid, universal community, which it isn't. It's like, it's both, it's culturally, socially, and economically specific in the same ways that, I'm not saying it's not better, I'm not saying it's not mine, I'm just saying that it is no more rooted in the natural order of things than any other way of living in the world is. And in order to set up the thrust of the whole thing, it's depicted as a little bit of a utopia. Anyway, it's unorthodox, it's on Netflix, it's streaming, it's 4 episodes, 1 hour each, and it's beautifully done. Check it out.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, before we go any further, Dana, we have some business, I'm sure. What do you got?
Yeah, Steve, a couple pieces of business this week. First of all, our Slate Plus segment this week is going to be about quarantine fitness. We talked about quarantine cooking a couple weeks ago. Now we're going to talk about what, if anything, we're doing to not just turn into big flabby blobs sitting inside all day with nowhere to go. And I think we all have very different answers to that question. And of course, if you are not a Slate Plus member yet, you can become one by going to slate.com/culture plus. As Julia discussed at the top of the show, we are sad about having to go bi-weekly rather than weekly after having done this show every single week together, not even missing, I don't think, hardly a vacation for over 10 years. And I know we ask for this every week, but in these straitened times when journalism is really in a perilous situation all around, your membership and your support are especially important and especially appreciated. So again, if you want to become a member for $35 for your first year, you can always go to slate.com/culture plus. Now, the last piece of business I want to do, which we didn't do last week because Julia had not quite settled on her comfort movie yet, which turned out to be Airplane, we'll talk about that shortly, is to talk about the comfort watch for our next show. And it's going to be my week to pick. So once again, I am doing my thing of choosing a fairly dark and not all that overtly comforting movie for my choice, just because it's one of my nearest and dearest. Steve, this is like one of my local hero level movies that I love so much that you and Julia may possibly be dead to me if you don't share my love. And that is Nicholas Ray's noir masterpiece In a Lonely Place from 1950, starring Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham. I've never gotten a chance to write about this movie or podcast about it, and yet I've watched it and thought about it more than, I don't know, just about any movie I know. And apparently you and Julia have never seen it. Is that possible?
I hadn't seen it because I wanted to read the novel first, which I have now done. I actually endorsed the novel probably about a year ago or so. I can't remember quite, but...
Right, the novel by Dorothy Hughes, right, which I have not read. I know you love, and I may try to pick it up and read it before our next show so that we can talk about both book and movie and how the adaptation works.
And in its own way, it's a really, really unnerving, cold-blooded read, brutal in its own way. And I know the movie's quite different, but I somehow wanted to live with the after effects of the novel for a while before seeing the movie, and I'm ready. I am so, so ready. Jesse David Fox is a writer at Vulture, the multimedia culture arm of New York Magazine. He's also the host of Good One Podcast. Jesse, welcome to the Gabfest.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. You've said on your show that everything is different living in this pandemic, and it's bound to affect the way people make comedy. We really want to get into that, but I'd like to start with something more macro, if that's okay, which is that I don't know how old you are, but I'm old. I'm fucking old, right? And so I used to watch SCTV and Monty Python back in the 1970s when irreverence was something you had to search for, you know, late at night or on PBS or at odd hours, you know, the very first SNL season, I kind of remember. And over the course of my lifetime, comedy's become big comedy. And that means that comedy is one of the ways in which we process reality and process like public tragedy in a weird way. I mean, that's the funny thing about it. Like, comedy is how Americans come to grip with what's happening to them politically, economically, and when there are big public tragic events. I mean, you would have thought 9/11 would have been impossible to process comedically, or if one tried, one would botch it horrifically. And yet The Onion proved, within a matter of days, proved us all wrong, that there was a publicly therapeutic function that comedy had taken on in American life. And I always think about this because it's as big almost as anything that's happened in terms of culture in my lifetime. And is this something you think about at all? Just how we got to the point where you have the job title that you have?
I mean, I think about it constantly. It's probably the thing I think about most. I'm working hypothetically on a book about sort of partly how that rise of how we decided to start taking comedians seriously. It was like 2002 or so is when people first started saying there was this group of people that's getting its news from The Daily Show. And that, plus I think also how we used comedians during 9/11, as you said, all just sort of created this thing where, like, these comedians are so good at talking and processing information and then being able to articulate at times when it's so hard for everyone else to articulate, that they prove themselves as sort of a public good. And then by 2009, comedy explodes again and has still been, you know, I called it a boom 6 years ago. And I think at this point, it might be, or hopefully will be, just like, this is what comedy is.
I do want to just now ask the question around the segment, which is, here we are, there is big comedy, and here we are, a synchronous global catastrophe is unfolding. What's the relationship between the two?
I mean, it is fascinating to watch. I mean, like, comedy is of, you know, all art forms, all live art forms are somewhat about connection between audience and performer. But for comedy, it is more extreme. I mean, like, comedians really depend on audiences for material, for understanding what works. But I think what you're seeing is when you remove the audience, it sort of like breaks the entire idea of what stand-up is. I was talking to Hannah Gatsby for my podcast for a future episode, and she sort of is, it's like without an audience laughter, it's not even stand-up anymore. It's sort of, she's like of the opinion, if a joke falls to an audience without any people in it, is it still a joke? And I think it questions all of that, where at the same time, I think there's a tremendous need for what comedians can do. As we saw with 9/11, this processing that we're all sort of doing, what feels like in slow motion, I do feel this missing element of, like, I want a person who can kind of articulate this moment. And I mean, I don't know if I've found one, at least not in the way that we've expected.
Yeah, it does not yet feel like we've gotten our Onion issue about this moment. You know, I mean, we've watched some stuff. We've seen the live from home SNL that delivered some catharsis and some, here's a bunch of humans who are funny performers responding to the same circumstance we all find ourselves in, but it didn't quite feel like an enraged and revelatory document about the moment.
You know, comedy has many functions, and as you said, I think catharsis is the one it's still able to do, and I think SNL, especially the most recent episode, was really able to do it successfully. But the grander thing of sort of giving people the vocabulary to speak about it themselves, I think especially comedians overrate how much people watch comedy to just learn how to say funny things or to have funny things to say to their friends. but also to have insightful mm-hmm. things to say to their friends, or just literally to know what they can say, where every day I feel like everyone's going through the same thing of like not knowing how to start an email. Like, are you supposed to say, how are you? How's it going? Hey, I know, you know, that sort of things. We sort of look to comedians to sort of tell us what we're supposed to say to sort of feel like normal people.
Jesse, on a recent episode of your podcast, good one, you talked to Maria Bamford and Roy Wood Jr. about this specifically, about doing comedy under the quarantine for coronavirus. And they had really different things to say. I was interested that it seemed to me in a way that Maria Bamford was more able to adjust, maybe being the incredibly introverted person that she is. She was more able to adjust to the idea of Zoom comedy and, you know, sort of not having laughter there in the room, but continuing to work on her stand-up from a distance, and was saying that it was more important to keep working than to actually have an audience, and she's trying to work in that void. Roy Wood Jr., on the other hand, was talking about the future of comedy clubs and saying that he can't imagine them ever dying, and that, you know, essentially that the live audience is an essential part of doing comedy. In a larger sense than the quarantine, even after the quarantine ends, it's obvious that live performance is going to take a while to get off the ground, and that many venues will have either closed or suffered financially. And I'm wondering what you think of the future of stand-up comedy, improv, etc., after all this is over.
Yeah, I mean, it's I go back and forth between really hopeful and really worried. I mean, it's an experience to be with other people and laugh, and I think on that end, it's made me appreciate stand-up more. It's made me appreciate improv, a thing I hadn't seen for a really long time, a lot more, because it's so about that connection. On the other hand, I can't imagine being in an audience with people. Like, it, you know, Roy Wood Jr. said a thing that I can't get out of my head, which is, if someone coughs in an audience right now, it would be like if a gunshot went off. And mm-hmm. and that is... you can feel that. Like, I mean, he is really good at talking. So like, he really was, as I said, is able to process it. But you can't imagine sort of people feeling safe enough to laugh, and sort of being safe is what allows comedians to like push boundaries to talk about difficult subjects. So I don't know. Like, it's one of the many things. It's just because it's so connective. It's an extreme of sort of what we're expecting when we get back to whatever normal is.
One question I have is just to zoom out, like, part of what made and we keep talking about The Onion, the iconic issue of The Onion that came out after 9/11. And if you are a listener who doesn't remember it or didn't check it out, like, go Google it and find it. It just really hit the exact right blend of mournfulness, shock, tragedy, and political critique. And, you know, having Jon Stewart as this kind of symbol of the fact that there was a, you know, what was not then called the resistance, but there was a group of people who found the leadership not tolerable and wanted a kind of ready scrutiny and critique on it, existed. And I've been trying to think, who is that under Trump? Like, what is the sustained politico-comedic response to the Trump administration? And is there that, and I'm just not watching it? Like, is that what John Oliver is? I think people do find his kind of long form research screeds to be valuable in this way, but is there some similar function? I mean, I guess part of why I wonder if there hasn't been a kind of cathartic, important comedic document yet of this moment is just that comedy's kind of in a different place in terms of its relationship to political critique now under Trump.
There's so much there there's the uniqueness that already existed about comedy under Trump, and the struggles to do comedy about Trump in terms of lasting comedy. You know, there's the ability for catharsis about Trump and just sort of like allowing people to check themselves and sort of know what's the truth. But sort of like that comedy we felt that really was able to shine a light on something different has not been able to be done with Trump, because Trump is such an obviously bad president in the truest definition of obviously. Like, he's a very shallow target. And at the same time, you have so many more outlets. So at the same time as all these things are happening, comedy is getting more and more niche. Fewer people are trusting the same person. So I think when when you want comedy to be connective, to it is harder when there isn't sort of agreed upon people. This is all to say, I imagine there are a lot of people who John Oliver is the person you're looking for. There's a lot of people who Trevor Noah is the person you're looking for. There's a lot of people who it's Desus and Mero. There's probably a lot of people who it's someone on Instagram that I've never heard of. It is frustrating. So for a thing like this, I imagine there are people who are getting a small dose of what we're all hoping for. Every week they may be getting like 5 minutes of relief or 5 minutes of sort of understanding, opposed to sort of like a grand gesture where we all unify and say like this comedy did the thing that we needed it to do.
Right. I mean, the kind of therapeutic exorcism that The Daily Show was night after night during the Bush years had to do with taking something, you know, liberals were really on their heels in a way. And the, you know, establishment liberal political response to Bush was so weak and so scattered that you needed someone to point out every day how absurd, the extent of the absurdity of it. Whereas, as you say, you know, Jesse, Trump is like, that's all right out on the dinner table as pungent. And you know, you don't need anyone to complete that circuit for you. So in a weird way, I don't think people are turning to comedy. I mean, maybe this is to see it through my own solipsistic lenses, but in a weird way, the Daily Show equivalent now is the Daily. You just want like Michael Barbaro and gray, po-faced sobriety to remind you that seriousness has a place in the world, and absent seriousness, we're going to go to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is partly why you see, even in the a lot of late night shows that we're talking about, the moments that we talk about are fairly serious and very straightforward. I mean, when I spent a day at Seth Meyers right after the election, it was very clear that how they approach it is very serious. The person who writes the Closer Look segment came from news. He was sort of like a perfect unicorn for this job because he also had an improv background. But like, he was hired there because he had a background in news. He was able to process all this information. And like, people appreciate just sort of people doing the work of just like, I can't read all this stuff. Can I not get it on a minute by minute basis? Can you please just like give it to me on a slower pace than I'm getting it?
All right, Jesse, before we go, what has made you laugh the hardest since the onset of the pandemic?
When I watched the most recent SNL, the one where the second of their two at homes, and I think when Keenan brought back What Up With That, which is a character that's done famously on the show, and he hadn't done for a while, him seeing that, and I sort of squealed with glee just the idea that he was doing it. And so I remember really laughing really hard at that, but it was a sort of different laugh of, then it wasn't a laugh of surprise as much as sort of like laughing of like seeing an old friend again, which I think is the laughter I'm seeing happening more often with myself in these times that we are in.
That's a great answer. All right, Jesse David Fox, it is great to have you on the show. I hope this is the first of many appearances.
It would truly be a dream, so thank you so much.
Awesome.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
Airplane is a 1980 comedy classic, really. It's written by the Zucker brothers, Jerry and David, and also by Jim Abrahams. It's a broad, really surreally broad parody of the Airplane disaster movie. It was popular in the 70s. There's also one from the 50s. It's kind of half based on. It starred Julie Haggerty and Robert Hayes and a bunch of other great comedic turns in the movie. The film was a... It was funny. It's both a huge hit. I mean, I remember when this movie came out. I saw it when it came out in the theaters. I think I probably even saw it multiple times. It made a ton of money off of a very small budget, which opened the eyes of Hollywood quite wide. But it was also kind of a cult classic. You know, it had a core of fans who just would repeat every line from it over and over. and over again. And it's now regarded as a pioneering classic of American comedy. And now we're going to ask the question, what it was like to rewatch it in 2020. But first, let's listen to a clip.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Well, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying, altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
I mean, the amazing thing about this movie, Julie, I should say it was your pick this week, and I it's about 90 minutes long. You could really lower the dipstick anywhere in those 90 minutes and pull out something that's like that and going to make you laugh. But before we get into how tasteless and weird this movie is to watch in 2020, you were non-existent when it came out in 1980. How did you discover this movie?
I'm not that young, Steve. I was existent, but I didn't go see it in theaters, nor do I remember Janet Madeline's rave review, which I was shocked to learn in our prep for this episode that this movie was like immediately hailed as a comedic triumph.
It has
the quality of a movie that kind of came out and banged around and then got rediscovered. But in fact, it was just like, wow, this is a real funny way to make a movie. What a funny movie. And cheap, too. Let's do more. Like, I had no, I had no cognizance of that until I prepped for this segment, because I've never thought about this movie before. I have merely watched it many times. Our faithful listeners may have noted that we didn't actually announce last week that we were doing this, because it was my turn again to promote, and I was like, what movie do I love besides Sneakers? It's only Sneakers. It's the only one. And then I was like, well, truly, by the metric of what other movie have I seen the most times, it's Airplane, because it was one of two VHS tapes that we owned when I was probably in my tweens, just judging by which living room I remember watching it in. And so I probably watched it like every month from when I was 10 to when I was 14. And then I'm not certain I've seen it since. Like, I think maybe one time 10 years ago, my husband and I showed it to his little siblings. Watching it again, there are definitely pieces of it that do not age well in terms of the race and gender politics of the transition from the 70s to the 80s, but it's still really freaking funny. I came away still pretty delighted by it. And I think, you know, it's one thing that is interesting to me about it is just the joke density. You know, your point about the dipstick, like everything is set up for a joke. There's like nothing happening on screen that isn't ostensibly funny. So when you think about things like The Simpsons, where the rhythm is just like, why not have a gag in a shot when you could have a gag in a shot? It just feels like a precursor of The Simpsons or 30 Rock or some of that kind of super dense, super jam-packed, like fruitcakes full of jokes type comedy that that has been kind of a watchword since then. And then just the kind of full commitment of the B-movie concept, and that even though there's jokes everywhere, everyone's playing it straight. I mean, there was an oral history in the AV Club, which we read in preparation for this, where they talked about casting the movie and just really trying to find these kind of B-movie actors and people who were not known for their comedic chops, because what they wanted was people who could, you know, just deliver these lines absolutely, absolutely straight. So while I cannot, as a modern human, endorse the jive talk portion of this movie anymore, I still find it very funny. And I do, you know, I was trying to think what it was about tween me that this appealed to, because it's all making fun of things I knew nothing about. Like, everything is a joke. It's a parody of Saturday Night Fever. It's a parody of like B-movies from the 50s and 70s that I never watched. There's a scene that's a parody of the iconic scene from Here to Eternity, not a movie I was familiar with at the time that I like fell in love with it. There's a joke that I only just this weekend got. You know, the part of it takes place in the kind of recovery hospital after Stryker is injured in a raid gone wrong in the war, where one of the injured vets thinks he's Ethel Merman, or it's actually played by Ethel Merman. Definitely didn't know that was really Ethel Merman as a kid. Like, I was just like, oh, I get it. Like, I know as an 11-year-old in the 90s or whatever it was that Ethel Merman is a famous, you know, figure. There was some, like, kind of yearning to know about the culture probably that informed, you know, the reflected half jokes that, and just kind of, you know, wanting to be a part of the grown-up world that would know what all these references were and sort of understanding that it was referring to things without totally knowing all the things. It was very funny to watch it as a grown-up and get more of it.
Dana, is this the first time you'd seen it, or when was the last time?
I was definitely not the first time I'd seen it, but I didn't grow up watching it over and over again like Julia. I think I probably saw it, you know, in the theater once and then maybe once on cable years later, and certainly not in, I don't know, more than 25 years or something. So it was a weird delight to revisit. I mean, vis-a-vis what Julia was just saying about the very referential, and referential specifically to old American culture, right? Hollywood, and even older than Hollywood. It's like there's sort of vaudeville level jokes in here, you know? That was what really, really struck me on this rewatching, was the zombie resuscitation of all these old Hollywood tropes and even actors, right? I mean, Leslie Nielsen and Robert Stack and Lloyd Bridges and Peter Graves, all of these people would have been familiar at the time as, you know, former Hollywood hunks who are now these silver foxes, you know, doing comedy in the sky. And that really struck me on this rewatch. That also that kind of Mad Magazine aesthetic, which is what Janet Maslin said in her very positive New York Times review, that it was sort of Mad Magazine humor on film. And I did grow up getting Mad Magazine at our house. It was my brother's sort of thing that his Mad would arrive and he would add it to his box of Mads and we would all pore over it. And it was very similar, the humor in Mad, in terms of being for young people, really for teenagers or even tweens, but the jokes all coming from this older register of American culture. So there was this kind of sense that, you know, by reading it, you were also learning what to make fun of, you know, and that's a really fun part of seeing this movie now. I think that the stuff that holds up the best, I mean, I had at times I was laughing in pure shock at the level of, you know, humor that you could get away with in 1980 that now is just so tasteless, not just the race, the jive talk translator jokes and things that Julie was talking about that really don't stand up and are uncomfortable, but there's a running joke about pedophilia, there's a running joke about suicide.
Oh yeah.
There's the scene where one female passenger is getting sort of hysterical and wrought up and people get online to slap her and talk sense into her, and like one guy on the line has boxing gloves. I mean, it's so over the top and absurd and now just so incredibly tasteless, but it made me think about just what a different world we grew up in, you know, even like the smoking section joke, right? Which, of course, has turned into a visual pun that his actual ticket is on fire. But I think the stuff that holds up the best really is just the absurd, absurd visual puns. And the one I wanted to gesture at that I know Julia loves too is the ongoing joke about Robert Hayes, the hero's drinking problem. Which is simply that he doesn't know how to drink, so he puts a non-alcoholic liquid in a glass and then throws it into his eye. And every time that happened, I died. It's just so ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous. I mean, what I find really revealing is that, as you describe, one of the more tasteless jokes that no one could get away with today, we're laughing, right? Like, that's the amount of laughing I did in spite of myself rewatching this was really startling. I mean, 3 minutes in, I was like, this is torture. I can't redo this. I mean, this is such a relic from my deep past. I have no interest in revisiting it. All of a sudden, I'm like herniating. I'm laughing so hard. It kind of weirdly still works. And to the extent that taboo is always a source of the deepest laughter, God, I laughed at a lot of things I'd be ashamed to admit I laughed at. I mean, the scenes where that little boy comes into the cockpit. And so let me make a kind of defense of that aspect of the movie, that for all the things that the movie makes fun of, that it does seem to be pretty equal opportunity, though I know that that's not an excuse. And if you came out with this movie today, you might as well move to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. That said, the funniest thing that it makes fun of is straight, white, older men. Dana, you sort of pointed to this. I mean, so much of the comedy that works in this movie comes from the fact that Peter Graves, who delivers these weird pedophilic comments, the reason they're funny isn't that pedophilia is even remotely funny. What makes them funny is that Peter Graves is an actor associated in the American mind in 1980 with one thing. He is Jim on Mission Impossible. You're a mission, Jim, should you choose to accept it. The most single, most po-faced, straight-faced, straight man people would have been familiar with from movies or TVs. And he doesn't fucking crack. He basically is saying these really repellent, really outrageous, really fucked up things as if he's still Jim. And then they don't stop there, right? It's like they keep throwing more, you know, central casting, slightly washed up white guys at you to play this sober Greatest Generation type. Lloyd Bridges, Leslie Nielsen, and Robert Stack play this sort of type, and that type comes in for it so unrelentingly for its self-seriousness in a way that maybe excuses a little bit the way in which other social types come in for it over the course of the movie. To me, that comedy works really, really well, and it launches the Police Academy movies with Leslie Nielsen. But I'm curious. I find this movie so elemental. It's like judging the sky or trees in a weird way. It, you know, every joke, right? It looks like I picked the wrong week to give up sniffing glue. It's a hat, it's a brooch. I mean, almost every joke, and there are about 1,000 of them, worked its way into the consciousness of moviegoers. Like, it's hard to, how do you step back from it? It's like, it is like stepping back from your own DNA and saying, what would I be like without it?
I mean, to me, what was most interesting about watching it now is that it's just a fascinating document of the pivot from the 70s to the 80s, right? I mean, there's all these Reagan jokes, and it was written and made in a moment where Reagan was on the political scene, but not yet the president. I do think you're right, Steve, that there's an equal opportunity-ness to the humor. Like, nothing is safe from mockery, that helps it age a little bit better than some other things from its era. But still, it's a document of a world where, you know, the one of the running visual gags is that all of the instructions on the plane are written in both English and Spanish, and all the Spanish is like this kind of pidgin jargon, right? Like, yua no smoka, as the Spanish version of no smoking. And right, that's essentially a joke at the expense of the idea of a bilingual country. Like, that's not great. We wouldn't do that. I'm not sure I would classify the drinking problem one as one that hasn't aged well. I think that joke, I put it in every show. Could a show be improved if you had the drinking problem joke in it? Yes. Like, and I guess alcoholism is also not funny, but sorry, I will not. That was not one of the jokes that made me uncomfortable or felt like it aged badly. That joke just seemed like a freaking hilarious, perfect bit of comedy that will stand the ages. But I think the kind of purity of the unwillingness to be reverential about anything is part of what helps the kind of mischievous spirit of the movie hold up a bit. Even if there were parts of it where I was like, ooh, guess I made Steve and Dana spend their weekend watching this.
Well, it's only 88 minutes of being offended, yeah. So I can take it. Can I mention two things that we haven't yet that I think are just absolutely central to this movie's success?
Oh my gosh, yes.
So one of them, of course, is Julie Hagerty as the stewardess, love interest, eventual co-pilot, right? I mean, really, it's her movie to an amazing extent. Even though, as you say, Steve, it's all about poking fun at these old white guys played by these old Hollywood actors, I feel like she has this old Hollywood element as well. She's this dizzy dame right out of Screwball, you know, and she just plays it so perfectly straight yet hilarious and gets exactly what kind of movie she's in and what she's doing. I just feel like she's Carol Lombard worthy in that role. And and it made me think also of her in Marriage Story last year playing Scarlett Johansson's mother as a sort of similar dizzy dame in a way and just still very funny and wonderful. And the other, and this really underlays every moment of the movie and is a giant part of its success, is the score by Elmer Bernstein, who's another old Hollywood hand. Elmer Bernstein, who scored, I don't know, movies from the 50s, like The Sweet Smell of Success is his movie. The Magnificent Seven is his movie, I believe. I mean, he was, you know, the lay on the strings Hollywood score guy and was an unusual choice for this score. And then afterwards, he sort of became the comedy score guy and went on to score Animal House, another big, you know, sort of broad comedy hits of that period. But I really noticed his score on this rewatch and how he is he's doing Mad Magazine musically in a way, right? So he's got these sappy violin love themes when the two lovers are talking, and then he can change in an instant to this, you know, airport style disaster movie suspense score. And there's really a lot of use of music in this movie, and it's exquisite. And reading again that oral history, that great long oral history of how it was put together, apparently Elmer Bernstein absolutely loved this movie, and the filmmakers talk about him seeing it for the 10th time and still laughing just as hard. And I think that comes across in his music, which is full of wit.
That's wonderful. All right, well, the movie is Airplane, and we derived comfort from it. I'd be curious to know what the listeners' relationship to the movie is, and if you haven't seen it, maybe don't, because we're going to get some emails if you do. But
the Zuckers are canceled.
All right, moving on.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
All right, well then, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. Dana, Dana.
Stephen, I guess I am going to endorse something that I suggested in a latter day moment that we might do as a topic this week because it became unexpectedly a big cultural deal, but we already had our topics chosen and we liked them. So I will stick with this for just an endorsement. But if you didn't see any of the Stephen Sondheim live stream that happened in honor of his birthday the other night, it's his 90th birthday this year. I think his birthday has already passed last month, but as a kind of quarantine tribute to him, a whole bunch of Broadway stars and others got together and did a live concert of Sondheim songs on Sunday night. I didn't watch it live. My daughter, who's an inveterate theater nerd, was glued to the screen and living through all the drama of, you know, the show starting almost an hour late and having no sound at first and really almost creating its audience by having those technical problems and delays. And I could tell from Twitter that it was going to be a huge thing from when it started and heard her upstairs just singing along, laughing, loving it. If it's too much for you to watch two entire hours of a recorded live stream of Broadway songs, I was just going to point to what I thought some of the high points were, and I haven't seen the whole thing yet myself, but I'm kind of revisiting it song by song. And I'll start with Melissa Errico's version of Children in Art, which is a Sondheim song that I wasn't familiar with at all and that she interprets really, really beautifully in a great setting. There's a duet of Beanie Feldstein and Ben Platt singing It Takes Two. Super adorable, and they're both incredible singers. Michael Cerveris, who is somebody I had seen on Broadway before, singing Finishing the Hat, another great Sondheim song. But if you only watch three songs from the Sondheim live stream, I would make them, I believe, they're the very last three. And that is the most gif-able of all that you've probably seen photos from, even if you didn't watch it, which is Meryl Streep, Christine Baranski, and Audra McDonald singing Ladies Who Lunch together while swilling their alcohol of choice. That was absolutely divine. My daughter called me into the room for it because she knew I would flip. She and I have watched both the Mamma Mia movies together endlessly, so we both absolutely thrilled to that. After that, it was Patti LuPone in her basement, which I've already endorsed on this show, singing Anyone Can Whistle really beautifully. And then finally, the closer to the show was an absolute killer, and if you survive it without just becoming a shell of yourself, I will be shocked. It's Bernadette Peters giving an a cappella rendition of No One Is Alone from Into the Woods, and sort of breaking up a bit as she does it. You know, at moments her voice breaks and she's choking back tears. It's obviously Sondheim is someone who's very important to her. She starred in the original Into the Woods on Broadway, and yeah, so I've already given you a lot of homework, but if you just boil it down to one song, please, please watch Bernadette Peters singing No One Is Alone a cappella. It's the theme of the pandemic, and it's just gorgeous.
I really enjoy Dana giving us the skinny and being like, if you only make time for three songs.
Yeah, I was going to ask Julia how you were going to limit yourself to only three.
No, clearly, I mean, I should have watched this, and I wish we thought to do it as a segment, because I don't... I just have a huge hole in my knowledge about Sondheim, and Sondheim is everywhere this year, including in the Julie Haggerty starring movie, right? You know, Marriage Story had two Sondheim sing-alongs in it. Plus, I think there were a couple other big Sondheim hat tips this year. So anyway, I will check out at least those three songs, if not more, on Dana's recommendation.
For whatever reason, and maybe part of it was being live, and it has to be live, I think some of it would work taped, but for whatever reason, of all these celebrities in quarantine singing from their basements that we've talked about and that have been going viral, usually to be laughed at over the last month and a half, this was the one that felt like a real show to me. It seemed like there were people gathered around their virtual hearth, just really thrilling to each song and each surprise star as it came along. And so maybe it won't be the same thing to watch it recorded, but I still recommend those three.
Hmm. All right, Julia, what do you have?
I want to recommend a story in the Los Angeles Times by one of our reporters, Deb Vanken, about a man named Ben Barcelona, who is a retiree. He was an immigrant architect in Los Angeles who, when he retired 8 years ago, began a habit of visiting a Los Angeles cultural institution every single day of his life. And he had a kind of a set schedule. He would do MoCA on Mondays, The Broad on Tuesdays, The Hammer on Wednesdays, LACMA on Thursdays, The Getty on Fridays. Then he would go to galleries on Saturdays and then visit the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels on Sundays, and occasionally would deviate, but basically did that every single day for 8 years. And Deb has written just a wonderful profile of this man and his kind of devotion to the aesthetic and what it has meant to him to no longer be able to have this regular pilgrimage as part of his life. He's 81. He describes celebrating a socially distanced birthday with his daughter, and then also how he started walking the streets of Los Angeles and finding art there, including in a Kentucky Fried Chicken building that, in the manner of some California establishments, is shaped like a giant chicken and or chicken bucket. So it's just a beautiful, beautiful feature on a really interesting denizen of this city and how he is responding to the moment. So again, the author is Deb Vanken. The piece is called "This 81-Year-Old Was LA's Most Devoted Museum Goer Until COVID-19 Shuttered Cultural Institutions," and we'll put a link to it on our show page.
Very cool. Okay, I'm very quickly two endorsements. One is that I didn't think I was going to get much out of this, but I clicked through to read a Harper's Magazine review essay on a new Kierkegaard biography. The biography is called Philosopher of the Heart by Claire Carlisle. The review is called Difficulties Everywhere by Christopher Beha, who I believe is an editor for Harper's. I was sort of, you know, dawdling along, you know, through the first few paragraphs of it, and then as it gets going, it gets really good. It is the perfect example of the kind of work that a review essay can do. First of all, it recapitulates the, you know, major touchstone experiences of Kierkegaard's life that make it a completely compelling life biography. It reminds you of what his major ideas were, places them in a historical context, while making it clear why they're compelling now to our contemporary situation, but also just kind of to the human condition. I mean, Kierkegaard, essentially, he created existentialism, right? That's basically what he did. And though he offered it up with a very unorthodox approach to Christian faith, in the 20th century, we inherit it without the Christian faith. I mean, essentially, the major European philosophers of the 20th century, you know, Nietzsche at the end of the 19th century, and then Sartre in the, you know, earlier part of the 20th century, and Heidegger, pick up on Kierkegaard and make him relevant to the concerns of a secular society looking for meaning, when we've come to realize meaning doesn't exist in the universe. Meaning is what we make and how we make it, you know, on and on. And then giving you a sense of why this book is, you know, what the quality of the book was, how well the story is told there, and you know, quoting from it well enough that you get a sense of the book. And this was a writer, Kierkegaard, who was just like central to my self-conception when I was young and callow. And like a lot of those things, you grow out of it and you move on. It's like, put away the childish things or whatever. And there's nothing childish about it at all. It has a obvious appeal to someone who's, you know, curious about what constitutes the self and what constitutes the mask, which you might be preoccupied by when you're 22 or 23. But it's, you know, it addresses really big questions about life, that work. And it was done in such a daring way that I think that's what really hit me, is how daring it was of Kierkegaard to write these semi-fictional, you know, to write from behind these masks that were meant to be like kind of deeply offensive to, you know, Danish society, 19th century society and mores, as a way of trying to get people to understand what was at stake in believing and not believing. I had forgotten this part of the story. He dies impoverished. Like, he really sacrificed a huge patrimony in order to live out his beliefs. And it's a portrait of intellectual heroism and a reminder of how unusual that is and what the stakes of that might be. And then the second thing I'm endorsing this week is rewatching Schitt's Creek with your 17-year-old daughter. It's so good the second time around. It's decency, it's humanity, and it's wit are better the second time around. You don't have to wait a half a lifetime to come back around to it, having mostly forgotten it, in order to find it refreshing a second time around. Like, I almost am looping back from the end of season 5 to season 1 with my daughter, and it is that show is so good. So very quickly, the review in Harper's is called Difficulties Everywhere by Christopher Beha. It's a review of a new Kierkegaard biography called Philosopher of the Heart. It is a very, very well done review essay, and of course Schitt's Creek we've talked about to no end on the show. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you,
Dana. Thanks a lot.
As always, Steve.
Yep, total pleasure. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page at slate.com/culturefest. You can email us, I say it every week, only because I mean it so sincerely. We get great, great listener feedback via email. So if you're inclined, please do it. We're at culturefest@slate.com. We also have a Twitter feed that's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistant is Rachel Allen Ford, Dana Stevens, and Julia Turner. I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. Please, please stay safe and be well, and we will see you soon.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.